Welcome to the Baseball America Podcast. Baseball America, bringing you baseball news you can't get anywhere else for more than 35 years. Now it's time to talk baseball.
Welcome once again to another Baseball America Podcast. Along with Will Lingo, I am John Manuel. We have a very special edition of today's Baseball America Podcast. We are joined here in the office by the founder of Baseball America, Alan Simpson, who was the editor of Baseball America through, I believe it was February of 2006, and now Alan is back in the office working with us on and wrapping up a very special project, and obviously a labor of love for Alan, is Baseball America's ultimate draft book. It chronicles the first 52 years of the Major League Baseball draft, and you know, obviously, Alan, we intended to have this book come out as a 50th anniversary for the baseball draft, and thought it might come out after the 2015 draft, but just so much information in this draft book that it took a little longer to finish. But first off, tremendous job on wrapping it up. But second of all, just wanted to touch base with you on kind of what, you know, the draft has always been central to what Baseball America has done, both since you started it and in the decade plus since you left Baseball America. What was it that got you started on being so passionate and so interested in baseball's draft?
Well, I think it goes back to the original draft. As I say in the introduction, I remember where I was from the first draft, Rick Mundy being drafted. I was home for lunch from going to high school, and for some reason it clicked. And 16 years later, when we launched Baseball America, the draft became a very, very central part of our coverage. Kind of odd in a way, because growing up in Canada, you know, I would naturally have an affinity towards the hockey draft, which I did to some degree.
I was going to ask you, were you as into the hockey draft as you were in the baseball
draft? I've had a fixation for... I was a hockey fan initially, up until I was about 11 or 12 years old. Then baseball took over, and the baseball draft was a natural out of that. Everybody else probably had a fixation for the hockey, or at least the football and basketball drafts. And to a lesser degree, the hockey draft. The baseball was the last of the drafts to come into play.
Hockey draft 63. A lot like it is now?
Somewhat. There was only, at the time it was 1963, and there were only six teams back then. The way that one used to work is the Montreal Canadiens, the reason why they were so good, because they got the first two French Canadian speaking players in every draft. So it wasn't a perfect draft in that sense.
Sacre bleu. So, that's not fair.
So baseball didn't quite go to that degree, but Kansas City A's at the time had the first pick, which was Rick Mundy, and they followed suit with Reggie Jackson. So they kind of knew what they were doing, sort of like Montreal advantage of knowing what they were doing. But through the years, obviously, the drafts of any kind have become quite topical, as TV has blown these things up, the NFL and the NBA and stuff like that. Baseball has obviously lagged behind quite extensively, especially when Major League Baseball chose to make it that way. And I think once the... Once things changed back in the late 90s, and they've made some effort to really popularize the draft, it'll never be as popular as the NFL or NBA drafts, because you're not dealing with finished products or known quantities. But I think the baseball draft certainly has come an awful long way, and I think probably if there's a target, it's the hockey draft, because the hockey has done a lot of things right, which I think baseball now is trying to do with... having it in an arena type setup and bringing all your players there with their families. And it's a great way of introducing amateur players to professional hockey, in this case professional baseball. And I think baseball will eventually get it right, but I think when they can get the draft moved to an arena type setup with fans there and every one of the first rounders there with their families and stuff like that. But it's a ways off still, but at least they're moving in the right direction.
Do you think that's going to require moving the date of the draft? This is sort of going into the ways we would make the draft perfect tangent, but we would get there eventually anyway.
But it's also topical. They just released the draft date last week. Next year it'll be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Right. It's going to be late. So it's the latest ever, you said? June 12th?
It is the latest. But I still think the All-Star game, and I think probably you've probably both mentioned that that's when it should be, is right in the midst of the All-Star game. Kind of a high-profile area. I think you would have an awful lot of baseball people there at the time, so I think there's other dates have been advanced. There was a date 10, 12, 15 years ago, late August was advanced. But I still think the best right now is where it is. But I still think the best date could be All-Star Game.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that first week of June is kind of anachronistic. I mean, the College World Series used to end the first week of June.
Well, it's obviously slated slotted in back there, and it's slotted there because all these seasons are just ending. The short season is starting about 2 weeks later. It's the only one of the drafts that is conducted really at the heart of the season.
Right.
You know, football and basketball, you've got some time to step away, and hockey's the same. But baseball does theirs right in the season, so I don't know where you could move it to. Could you move it to July, or could you move it to August? To get away from these players having to immediately step into professional baseball. I think that if that was the case, you'd probably see a situation where you'd have more than 22 players over the life of the draft have gone directly to the big leagues. You know, mm-hmm. because I think if they had the advantage of a full spring training, or back it up to instructional league, then a full spring training, I think you'd see more players go step right into the big leagues. But that's the nature of having the baseball draft right in the heart of the season.
So was the thing that captured your interest about the draft sort of what you put into Baseball America, too, seeing the players at the entry level and following their progress?
The draft really for any sport is the bridge that takes you from amateur to professional mm-hmm. baseball. I had great interest in both things. So it was kind of a natural, I think, that you know, if you followed the minor leagues, you followed college or high school baseball, the draft was a natural to be interested in both those. And I recognized immediately that we're dealing with unknown products. Back in the day, gosh, I think maybe one or two people had heard of Rick Mundy beforehand, but nobody had heard of Les Roar, the number two pick, or anybody else that followed after that. And heck, came way pretty much until 1981 when we had a dramatic swing from high school to college players in the first round. And it's pretty much
conveniently
been college.
Enough, that was the year you started All-America Baseball News.
Conveniently enough, yes, that was the year, and that was also the year we had a 54-day strike in the major league. So in that sense, it played right into the hands of the paper.
Because I wanted to ask you about that draft. I mean, those first couple of drafts, I mean, I don't mean to make the story about me. Like, I was very proud and happy that we had Mickey Moniak going 1-1. Like in late May, when it was unsettled who would go first overall in the draft. And we have so many resources. There's so much talk about the draft. I mean, I was doing weekly spots on MLB Network this week about the draft the whole month of May. So I should have been in that mode. You were the only person covering the draft. And yet in 1981, you knew early in the year you had Mike Moore as a candidate. You had Joe Carter early in the year as a candidate. You had Kevin McReynolds, who went sixth on the cover of the first magazine. And 82, I remember going back and reading, Sean Dunstan, Jimmy Jones. Who were the guys at the top of that draft? I forget, there's someone else.
The infamous Augie Schmidt was the second pick on that draft.
That's right. So. One of two Golden Spikes Award winners, never to reach the major leagues.
Yep.
I know you know the other one.
I'd have to put some thought
into that. Year 2000, right-hand pitcher, University of Sliders and Curves.
Oh, yeah.
Kip Boeknight is the other one.
Oh, Boeknight.
Kip Boeknight.
Yep.
Sorry. But so I knew. So how were you getting that information so accurately back then? That always boggles my mind. How were you?
Well, I'll tell you, it was a guess, because really 3 days beforehand, Seattle had the first pick in 1981, and their target was Ron Darling.
Okay.
But he had an agent, which wasn't very common back then, so the Mariners sort of shifted off and went to Mike Moore. But
you did have a big Ron Darling feature that
We targeted the draft right from the start, and we managed to... I made some contact with a lot of scouting directors in that first year, and they were more than happy to just tip us off, because nobody had ever come to ask them about draft information before.
You care about my job?
By we, you really mean you. I mean, I
know
you
have people working. You know, I will give some credit to Peter Gammons in the Boston Globe, and Tracy Ringlesby in the Seattle, then the Post Intelligencer. We're doing some pre-draft coverage, but not extensive nationally, at least. But I just had made up my mind we'd have some draft coverage from the start, because I was seeing the NFL and NBA were getting some attention for their drafts, and I kind of always asked the question, why can't baseball? You know, they're every bit as popular as those sports at the major league level. And I was thinking, gosh, let's see what we can do to make the draft a little bit more popular. The minor leagues weren't very popular at that time, so I think we tried to popularize that part of the game. And the colleges, all of a sudden, were becoming somewhat more popular, mostly I think because ESPN and televising the College World Series, but there are all kinds of these areas of the game, especially the draft below the big league level, were simply not getting the attention. I felt with some exposure, these could become popular. And I think the draft took time because Major League Baseball wanted to quash the information for another 20 years. And
right. As reporting for the draft started to increase at least a little bit, Major League Baseball actively sought to.
Well, they did. And sure enough, because I think you'll remember back in your days of starting at Baseball America, the most popular day for website traffic, as limited as it was, by far was the draft.
Oh, yeah.
And I think MLB.com, when they started launching things and doing their own coverage of the draft, they're by far and away their biggest days were the draft. There was hidden interest in the draft, and I think it may not take its rightful place up there with the other drafts, but it certainly has increased exponentially over the years.
The amazing thing to me is that the NBA draft has kind of come closer to MLB's. Their draft is so much younger.
Right.
It is international. I do think that's and it's also at the other same time, it's a complete opposite. It's basically a 2-round draft.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I love looking back at old NBA drafts and seeing guys who were 7th-round picks and these kind of thing, or 11th-round picks. But I do think that shorter draft for the NFL and the NBA increases their how important it makes every round more important.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if baseball can ever get to those.
Well, it's
because the hockey draft takes so long time, doesn't it?
Well, no, it's also 7 rounds right now as well.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'll just break it down in terms of some of the research I've done. The first round picks, you're basically every NBA and NBA or NFL first rounder plays in their leagues.
Yep.
The hockey's 92%, baseball's still 69%. So I think that's what you're dealing with. You're dealing with products that are not ready to play, and if in a lot of cases are never ready to play. And I think that's the difference. Every player that's taken in the NFL draft is essentially going to play this year. That's it. And the NBA draft, they have to deal with the finished products, those players that are going to have to play right away. You have the minor leagues, and there's the reason why you have the minor leagues is to develop the baseball drafts. So there's a huge difference there. And hockey is somewhat the same because with 3 or 4 exceptions, you typically don't see the top draft picks play in the NHL the next year. So baseball is a ways off in that regard.
Yeah, NBA and NFL, you're drafting them to plug into your major league team right away.
Yeah. Yeah.
So unless you're the Chargers and Joey Bosa, but I guess we won't go there. So this book is laid out chronologically, correct? I mean, just go over some of the basics, I guess,
for people who
haven't already worked.
Yeah, it's 65 through 2016, so that's 52 years of draft, and it's laid out in that order. There's a couple of features up front, sort of, just try to define how the draft has grown through the years and sort of a lot of the dynamics of it. And I think we have one chapter concentrated on what it was like before the draft came into being. But I think when you really look at the baseball draft, most of the names have never meant much to anybody. But I think if you look at it in hindsight, which is obviously what we've done with the book, that's when the draft really baseball draft is really really becomes important. I'll make a case that it's every bit as much more intriguing reading as football, as the NFL and the basketball drafts. Because you go back and look at Cal Ripken was a 2nd rounder, and you look at in 1978. Well, that didn't mean much of anything at the time, but it sure does now. Bob Boyce was the 1st rounder that year for the Orioles, and gosh, he didn't make it out of A-ball and. So I think one thing that really puts it into perspective is this year's Hall of Fame class. You've got Ken Griffey Jr. is the first number one pick ever to reach the Hall of Fame, and you got Mike Piazza as the latest draft pick ever to play in the Hall of Fame. So that points out exactly how inexact the baseball draft is.
It's kind of shocking how inexact it is in comparison to the other drafts. I mean, that's the thing that blows me away about it,
and the sheer volume of the baseball draft too comes through in the book, because you have so many rounds, so many players.
Right.
You have not only the great baseball stories, but you see all the people who were drafted in the baseball draft who went on to fame in other sports or even other walks of life in general.
Yeah, you've had 70,000. We went over the 70,000 mark in the baseball draft picks this year. That's a pretty staggering number, and for all the guys that have made it great, and you've got a ton of first rounders that are their story is every bit as intriguing as some of the players that did make it. So that's where a lot of the book went, is some of the failures and why they failed, and just the pressures that were on these players, there's a balance there between the Chipper Joneses and telling the story of a Kevin Brandt who never made it out of rookie ball as a first rounder and stuff like that. So it's.
This draft book really starts with the original draft book, which came out in 1989.
Right.
When did you get the idea to do the original draft book, and sort of how did that process?
Well, it was based on 25 years, so that was a good round number. We'll acknowledge that this was intended to be a 50 year, but it didn't. But the sheer volume of the book, it just...
Did you hear 70,000 players? That's volume.
Yeah, they're all in there. So it's... but I think it was just my fascination with the draft. And through the early years of Baseball America, we would print various lists from past years. And it was the response from the people didn't even realize that these players were drafted in these years when, because there's no history of the baseball draft of any kind. We didn't have Baseball Reference. We didn't have any of the internets that you could research most of this
and
material.
Even like the Baseball Encyclopedia or similar reference books, they didn't have all the old
draft
lists.
They breezed over it. Never had all the old draft lists. But I had gone up a couple of years beforehand to the commissioner's office and spent 3 or 4 days up there just going through all their files and just copying all their draft lists, copying a whole bunch of other information. So it was in the works for a couple of years. I did a lot of microfilms and just went through a lot of old newspapers and just pulled out relevant draft information, such as it was. It wasn't extensive in those days, but piecing it together was like being a scout. You're really digging and researching information and stuff. So it kind of came together as a 25th, and I think the big difference between 25 and 50. We were retelling a lot of the same stories through those first 25 years, but I've since got access to a lot of bonuses, and you can retell a draft completely by just looking at some of the signing bonuses. So the first 10 years of the draft, and the average first round bonus was $40,000. Now it's 2 point whatever.
Yeah, that was how I thought would be a good way to close. People love talking about signing bonuses, and that's really what the genesis for the draft was. The bonus babies.
Absolutely.
When it was just all amateur free agents were getting out of control. I wrote that. I talked to Rick Reichard, what was it, a year and a half ago? 2 years ago?
Yeah.
I think it was the 50th anniversary of the draft. And just him talking about how how he was resented through when he first came into the major league for the signing bonus he had, when his bonus was, $205,000. He was getting basically twice what most Major League stars were getting just in a bonus.
Well, the bonuses in 1964 were larger than the Major League total of the Major League contracts that year. So that tells
just
you
just the signing bonus.
Just the signing bonus. And that tells you what precarious state baseball was at the time, and they had to do something because the bonuses were just going out of sight. The minor leagues were just falling apart at the seams, and the Yankees were winning everything in sight. The game had to change, and the draft was what changed it. And I think it's been pretty significant.
It's been a success. In your mind, did you ever think that we'd get to this point where the bonuses are, where we have kind of this hard bonus pool? I mean, it seemed like the story of the draft when I started here, when you started here, Will, in the 90s was just bonus escalation. Every year was a bonus
escalation chart. Every year.
Now it's Major League Baseball that sets how much the bonuses will escalate. And it just seems like the owners are, okay, as long as we know what we're going to pay.
Yep.
We'll pay it.
Yep.
Did you ever think we'd get to this point, covering it?
I sense that probably something would happen because it had to happen, just like something had to happen in 1964. It took a long time for it to happen. But when you've got the NFL and the NBA and NHL, really have bonus caps, it was logical something of significance would come to baseball. It pretty much has, and it's the most workable solution we've seen in 30 years at least.
Right. It just took what it took. So from 10 years, just say... Harold Baines was like the low point in 77, right? Didn't he sign for, $40,000?
Well, he signed, that was the White Sox. That was the White Sox, I think, signed about six players this year. One of them, $32,000, I think, was Harold Baines' bonus. And I think Bill Gullickson had 77 as the second pick, so that was more a case of the White Sox.
But in 65, though, Rick Monday, he was right around $100,000.
He was 100. He was 100, and his record held up for about 10 years.
And then, but still 22 years later, Ken Griffey Jr. was $160,000.
Right. It was the next year after that started taking...
Right.
Well, no, Andy Bennis was 88. His was a pretty significant jump, and everything after that. Scott Boras pretty much was the...
So that's definitely an era in draft history, is the era of escalating bonuses. And then there's sort of the era of baseball trying to figure out what we want to do.
Oh, yeah. Especially in the late 90s. And it's interesting when you look back at the success, you know, of sophisticated scouting would probably logically make the success rate of first rounders and high rounders much better. But the two worst drafts in history from a first round standpoint were 1999 and 2000.
Right.
You know, they
right.
were less than, in those 2 years, less than half the first rounders played in the big leagues.
Those are brutal drafts to look back at, because 2000 I've been looking back at somewhat recently because those players are about to be done. But the best players from that first round are Utley and Adrian Gonzalez.
Yeah.
And Adrian Gonzalez was that compromised first round pick.
Yeah, it was a sign. They were both signed high, heavy signability drafts. You see a lot of first rounders who ended up in the second round and vice versa. And I think they learned the error of their ways of not doing it that way.
And see, I always think of 99 as a good draft because it started off with two guys who did become impact players in Hamilton and Beckett. But after that,
it started off good. But then you look at 2004. In 2008, we've seen 27 of 30 first-rounders in both those years. I know in Matt Bush's case, it took 12 years to get there. But
he got there.
He got there, finally.
So, yeah, 2008, though, is the other one that was 27 out of 30.
27 of 30. Well, that's good. We never saw those back in the day, but...
That is pretty good.
So those are the two best in terms of number of first-round picks reaching.
Yeah, the first era of the draft was very much, it seemed like, teams trying to figure out sort of what is this process?
Yeah,
how do we best approach it?
Yeah, the prominence of college players back then wasn't significant. And if they'd been drafted beforehand, they were stuck in the secondary phase. So I think the first round was diluted a little bit because of all the college players that ended up in the secondary phase. And in fact, you had one draft, I think it was 71, that every first rounder was a high school player. So obviously that began to change fairly quickly after that.
Yeah, that's another thing we don't think about anymore. But there were multiple dates of the draft, multiple phases.
Yeah.
So really, 65 to 86 is a pretty self-contained era. Those first 22 drafts.
With the four drafts.
You had multiple drafts. So, you didn't always have a January draft, right? When was that phased out?
It was phased out after 86.
Okay, so it was.
The first one was 66, and then it phased out in 86.
So those first 22 years, to me, that's like a whole separate era. The money in that era was basically the same. You had very rare exceptions of guys who stepped out significantly over $100,000, right?
Pretty much. Yeah, ironically enough, it was the reason why that they phased out the extra phases, because a lot of the first rounders in those lesser phases were equating themselves as first rounders from a money standpoint.
Gotcha.
And then, even though you roll it into one, they were getting the money just took off.
Yeah.
So regardless.
But then 87 to about what would you say 87 to like 96 is this other period, because the 96 draft is when it kind of started to go haywire.
Well, Brian Taylor in 91 was what really took it from a record of John Olerud's record so that was the first enormous jump to 1.55, and then the loophole free agents of 96 put an entirely different spin on things
that kind of at 87, if you wanted to, I guess, include it, would you go like 87 almost to like, when did the, it's like 2006 was the last year without any signing deadline. So 07 was when the signing deadline started. 06, your last draft and follow class. That's kind of like
last draft and follow, and then we had the August 15th signing deadline, and then it was moved back to July 15th. So that's so like, August 15th was did not work.
But like July 7th to like July 11th is almost like its own little self-contained era in the draft, because you had the August 15th deadline, so all the top players signed in the middle of August. But you also had hard, but you had softer slots. But it's a different, the deadline makes it a different period. Because before that, if you didn't like your offer, you just waited.
That was one of your main bargaining tools. If you really wanted to hold out, you just drew it out as long as possible.
Well, your first setting foot in your first day of class used to be it. Then all of a sudden, Scott Boras came along and suggested, well, you don't have to go back to school at all. So you're seeing so significantly more Jeff Weavers and Stephen Drew, JD Drew, and those players who weren't using that as your deadline anymore. And so that's why they had to. But that July 15th deadline coincided with the signing bonus pools, and so the two of those has really significantly changed things.
This era, since the 2012 draft, is a much tidier draft.
Oh, much, much more so.
Even with the whole Brady Aiken, Jason Nix, Jacob Nix, that Astros 2014 draft, no matter how you slice it, this is a much tidier, cleaner. more orderly draft year, it feels like.
This year, one player in the first six rounds didn't sign.
Right.
That was unheard of.
Oh, was it, how many in the top first 10 rounds? It was like four.
Four in the first 10, I think it was, yeah.
And most of them did it well before the deadline.
Oh, yeah,
too.
Much before. Much tidier process. So they've accomplished what, even though the money's significant, they've accomplished what they intended to accomplish 30 years ago.
That's it. So how do we get to this point? The best way to find that out is to buy the Baseball America All-Time Draft Book. What's the actual title? Well,
America's Ultimate Draft Book.
By Alan Simpson. Alan, the passion of Alan's, first of all, his passion for the game started this freaking magazine and is the reason why we have Jaws. But second of all, it's channeled into this book. So, Alan, we're excited that you did that book. Thank you for doing it with us, and thank you for talking about
it. Well, thanks, guys, and thanks for all your help in terms of your contributions.
Well, I didn't do Jack. Thank Will, but thank
well,
you.
Well, no, you've written a few stories through time there, John, and I may have liberally pulled a few sections here and there.
Yeah, one thing to note, we've talked about the signing bonuses, about all the data that was collected, but also the stories in the book are really one of the things that sets the book apart. Because
it's not just a reference book.
Right.
It's not just a book of lists.
And there are so many people you've never heard of who have fascinating stories because their career went south or they got hurt or whatever, and a lot of them are chronicled in the book.
Yeah, it's intended to be a cross-section of players that made it and players that didn't make it. And when 13.6% or 13.8% of the players make it, that means you've got 86% of the players that don't make it, and a lot of their times their stories are everybody is fascinating. So, but we've got all 70,000 players in the book. We've tried to highlight which players played in the big leagues, how long they played, the highest levels they reached, and we've got signing bonuses for a whole lot of them as well.
I say look for the draft drops. When I was looking through sections, I love the little draft drop, little insert into some of the lists. So even the reference part of it has little snippets of stories, relatives, guys who played other sports.
Women who were drafted. Because there are so many players and so many stories to tell, you can't tell them all, but in the draft list themselves, in addition to the signing information, whether they played in the big leagues, etc., for notable players, there's a little note for those guys just sort of set aside from the list so you can find out more about, which is sort of the maximum amount of information possible.
You got Mary Lou Retton's father, Ronnie, was drafted, for instance. He's in there, so.
I did not know that. And we did not list, I'll throw this in, that your son got a first-round pick this year, too, in Jeff Simpson, area scout for the Milwaukee Brewers.
Well, that's
kind of a neat thing to chronicle, to wrap up the draft.
Pretty neat deal, but that was not going to make the book.
Right. Well, a lot did make it, because there's 70,000 players to chronicle. So, Alan, thanks again for joining us. For Alan and Will, I'm John Manuel. We'll wrap up this edition of the Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.
This concludes our program. Want more in-depth baseball coverage? Be a better fan. Visit BaseballAmerica.com to get more comprehensive baseball coverage.